Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Catherine Smith. And during that last segment there, Catherine, I realised that there's about maybe 32 minutes, incidentally 33 minutes of airtime that we possibly got left. And it occurred to me during the last segment, just listening to you speak about issues we're discussing, it was just, man, I could just listen to it for hours.
You're flattering me now, aren't you?
The gargantuan content of your knowledge and the way you present it is very simple to understand, yet so compelling that it just freaks you out, and at the same time really makes you feel enlightened, and you're like, oh, we're all going to die, but at least I know about it, so it's awesome.
I hope I'm not giving the message that we're all going to die. I mean, although obviously, you know, none of us are going to be probably physically immortal, but...
Yeah, that's my conclusion. But yeah, I was just wondering, would you be able to stay to the end of the hour? Because
I'll stay to the end of the hour for you, special for you, Vinny.
All right.
Okay. Yes, what we were talking about in terms of, you know, the parents' reactions, you know, to, you know, an offer of help for their children. It is very interesting, and it's also very sad. And I found the same thing. I mean, I was sort of one of the people who essentially introduced sort of biological sort of treatments for autism into New Zealand in terms of actually doing an outreach to parents of autistic children and saying, you know, there are treatments that can help, not necessarily for every child, but for some children with autism. And, of course, I mean, it's like any treatment that you try for any condition. If you don't try it, you will never know whether or not it actually would have worked. And one of the things I did was going back, trying to think... Well, it would have been probably 12 years ago, was run a seminar for parents of autistic children, which I got publicised through the Auckland branch of the Autistic Association, if I recall, because I had gone to the conference that was held by Autism New Zealand, and I was absolutely appalled, I've got to say, for a few reasons. The first reason was that there was no discussion of treatment options for the physical causes of these children's conditions at all, other than psychotropic drugs. And they weren't... I mean, I've got to say, at that point, I guess it wasn't as bad as it could be, because now these things are dished out like lollies. At that point, they were sort of more talking about sort of drugging for the stressing symptoms that were difficult for the child and difficult for the parents, such as using... you know, medications to so that children would sleep as opposed to not sleeping, because, I mean, you'd probably be aware from your work with autistic children that it's very common for these children to have incredibly disrupted sleep patterns, and the exhaustion and depression that this can cause parents from absolutely chronic sleep deprivation is a major issue. You know, this whole conference is essentially sort of devoted to, you know, looking at some sort of educational approaches, and of course they are very valuable and they're necessary to have appropriate education. But again, in some respects, this was a red herring, because unfortunately, you know, there's not enough funding in the education system for the therapies these children actually need. Most parents can't actually afford to pay for the hours of special education that aren't funded for their children. And if you have a child that has an treatable yet untreated physical contributing factor to their autism, actually just trying to educate them without treating that underlying physical problem is to some degree a significant waste of time. And so I went to this conference and I looked at all, you know, sort of all the sort of issues that were being presented, and I said, well, somebody's got to do something. Plus, I got really absolutely peeved, I've got to say, with the organisers, because they actually chucked me out of the conference because I had prepared a leaflet on basic sort of biological approaches to autism treatment. And I'd gone in there with a press pass, and I was going to write it up for Healthy Options, which was, at that point, the natural health magazine in New Zealand. It went out of business 6 months before we started the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine. We'd actually had the idea to do natural medicine for many years, but because we had a great deal of respect for Janice Ann Priest, who was a nurse who retrained as a natural therapist who ran Healthy Options, we didn't start it. We didn't want to sort of compete. We didn't think there was room for two natural health magazines in the New Zealand market. But be that as it may, you know, I went in there on a press pass, and because I was handing out these leaflets that went against the paradigm and the party line that, you know, autism is genetic and there's nothing you can do about it other than sort of, you know, try to give these children the special education that they need, I got literally, told to vamoose from this conference. So after that, I ran a seminar which was attended, I think, a long time ago, at least 20 or 25 parents. And out of those parents, one of the attendees actually wanted their child treated. The rest had been so brainwashed into believing that it was a genetic condition. And there are some genetic conditions that can cause autism. There's a condition called Fragile X, which is always tested for if a child has autistic symptoms. A significant, 30 or 40, 50 years ago, yes, probably a significant proportion of quote-unquote autistic children had Fragile X. These days, it's a very, very small proportion. It's always been a rare genetic problem. And most of the children who are autistic these days are not due to having, it's not due to having Fragile X, it's due to some other cause. And
what I noticed is that when the diagnosis first comes about, the parents will try everything and anything. And incidentally, the only everything and anything that they're aware of is what the doctor recommends. Right. And depending on the doctor, I'd probably say the vast majority of the case, they'd go with drugs or this specialist, that specialist, who costs a little bit extra or so on and so forth. So they get drained of money, they get drained of time, no delivery of results, I believe that it creates a permanent despondence with the disease affecting their child and the parents themselves.
That's correct. That's right. I mean, they get drained of energy and they get drained of hope. I mean, in that respect, autism is not any different from any other chronic disease which has a significant impact on either people's life expectancy or quality of life. I mean, the same thing happens if people get a diagnosis of cancer and, you know, they may do, you know, what the specialist says first, you know, which is have the operation followed up with radiation or chemotherapy or whatever, if they've, you know, gone through this straight oncology route, as most people do. And when that doesn't work, in some cases they will try nothing more. Because, you know, people invest a certain amount of hope in any therapy that's been tried, and I guess it's not really true to say that hope is a finite resource, but certainly people can get to the point where, as you were saying before, personally they just cannot face having their hopes disappointed again. They essentially do not dare hope for anything better than what they've got, even if, what they've got is pretty intolerable, you know, watching their child, being in a handicapped and often very distressed state. And that, you know, as you know, is the very sad thing for many autistic children. They're not simply in their own world and in a happy own world. They are frustrated and unhappy, and because they've got needs and desires, and they'd like to communicate them, but they don't know how to. And
it's funny that you should mention that. I think one of the last days of working with one of the boys I was looking after, I saw in his eyes, and I've seen this expression in my own self, of sort of desperation, like this intense sadness, like he was wanting to get something through to me, and he was really upset and quite sad and depressed that he couldn't, sort of thing. And I know that feeling, and I know that look. And I talked to his grandmother, and I said to him that that's what I saw, and she says, "Oh well, he is what he is."
That's right.
Just,
I mean.
In order to cope with that situation, which they believe is incurable, I think that they've had to create a blocking mechanism.
Well,
they've tried to block their child out entirely.
Yes, I mean, the trouble is, if you are with somebody who is suffering from that degree of chronic distress, if you are a very empathetic person, potentially that child's pain or that, you know, if it's an autistic adult, or if it's somebody else with a very severe condition, you know, which is painful in some way, whether, you know, they're suffering from some chronic physical pain or emotional pain, or, you know, or whatever the situation happens to be, you potentially, you know, if you are very empathetic, remain in a very open state, that pain can very badly impact on you. And you see that in health professionals who work with people on an ongoing basis who have got either severe conditions or life-threatening illnesses. You know, they develop a sort of a professional armoring, if you like, whereby, you know, they see people as a case. They are no longer they do sort of create sort of barriers so that they are not susceptible to sort of picking up on that person's pain the way they would if it were a relative, for example, or a close friend or whatever. And it is a sort of a psychological survival mechanism on the part of health professionals, and also, you know, as people who are involved in a sort of a caregiving relationship with somebody, where this prognosis is bad and unlikely to get any better.
The worst thing about it, Kath, is that the reason for these ongoing illnesses in all too many cases is that the health system has failed in its duty to protect people's health and prevent these kind of conditions from appearing in the first place.
Well, you are 100% right about that, because potentially if sort of preconceptual care were to be integrated in a careful and comprehensive manner into the public health system, we could be preventing large numbers of children and their families from suffering problems like autism, and also from developing other sort of conditions that will sort of cause lifelong health problems, also developmental issues. You know, prematurity, for example, is associated with poor nutrition in the very sort of preconceptual period and first trimester of pregnancy. And people actually have no idea, I mean, that you should not be dieting in many cases if you're trying to get pregnant. People have no idea, for example, that on the whole, that aspartame, you know, found in, you know, all those diet soft drinks, and often it's in gums, even if they're not labelled as sugar-free, and it's in some nutritional supplements produced by some pharmaceutical companies, and it's in a lot of products you wouldn't necessarily expect it to
be. It's in Lemsip. I found it was in Lemsip, you know. It's like, oh, I've got the flu, you know, it'd be really good for that flu, some aspartame.
Mm-hmm. And people have no idea. I mean, these are easily avoidable toxins that potentially, you know, aspartame's been shown to be carcinogenic in animal tests. It's also known to be neurotoxic. Consuming it in pregnancy, and it's also in the gums that are being promoted to pregnant women for smoking cessation.
I believe the aspartame tests on rats killed every single rat in the test. While Donald Rumsfeld was the CEO of Sarah Lee, who was instrumental in getting the use of aspartame as an artificial sweetener legalized in America. And when it goes above room temperature to any significant heat, it turns into formaldehyde. And they got these trucks that are shipping, you know, raw coke and what have you all across America, and they're sitting there baking in the Texas sun while they're cruising along the highway.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's wretched, you know. We have the system set up where as long as it makes money, it's okay. And what happens at the end of it? I mean, you have children either being born in a compromised state, in some cases, or if they're born, you know, as babies deserve to be, healthy and beautiful, well, then you have the Ministry of Health, with, you know, empowering a whole sort of army, literally, of sort of doctors and nurses to sort of guilt trip parents into vaccinating them on the basis that if they don't get vaccinated, they're going to die from some infectious disease, you know. Even though, you know, deaths from infectious disease in childhood in New Zealand account for actually a very, very small proportion of childhood deaths. What kills babies in New Zealand is complications of prematurity, primarily. And you have still a reasonable number of, you know, sudden infant deaths, which have been severely attributed to things like accidental smothering in the parental bed, or, but in some cases are probably due to vaccine adverse reactions, which are simply unrecognised. And in terms of, you know, mortality for older children, you've got accidents and cancer being the leading causes of death of mortality in older New Zealand children. Teenagers, you know, you suicide.
Yeah, we actually have the highest teenage suicide rate in the entire world, as far as I know. And there's a good organisation known as CASPER, you know, named after the friendly ghost, that's trying to address that really, really massive plague on this country caused by pharmaceutical drugs. We'll be right back.